Well, this is a test run for the Olympics. And in the Olympics, there's no dinking around.
Keegan Randall wins again at Kincaid. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 8th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, officials at McLaughlin Detention Center respond to scrutiny over sexual abuse claims.
We take it very seriously and it challenges us to make sure we're being diligent, that kids are being kept safe.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Keegan Randall won today's classic sprint at the U.S. Cross Country Ski Championships at Kincaid Park in Anchorage. The win gave her a sweep at U.S. Nationals this week. She topped the podium after all four events. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Spectators lined the gates at the Kincaid Stadium to watch the most anticipated race of the day, the women's sprint final. Alaskan skiers claimed four of the seven spots in the final, all of them skiing for Alaska Pacific University. Keegan Randall held a comfortable lead for the entire 3.5 minute race.
And here comes Keegan Randall, bib number one. She's got about 8 or 10 meters over Laura Vallis, her ABU teammate.
She flashed a huge smile as she crossed the finish line, and she started answering reporter questions before she even had a chance to fully catch her breath.
I think what I can really take away from this week is my body can take a lot. So this has been an incredible week. Performance-wise, it's been really fun. The energy's been great. You know, there's been plenty of competition to keep me on my toes, and it's just great to finish off. A good full week.
Randall said today's conditions with a firm track and blue skies were as perfect as you could find anywhere. She says she felt a little sluggish in the early heats, but wasn't willing to give up the lead.
Well, this is a test run for the Olympics. And in the Olympics, there's no dinking around. I wanted to go all out and test it, you know, and it worked. It felt good.
Today's classic sprint is the same event Randall is hoping to win a medal in at the Vancouver Olympics. She has about a month to prepare for that test.
I'm really happy with the way my body held up this week. I've maintained a lot of energy, and I really feel like I'm still a couple weeks away from peak fitness, but I'm confident I'm really going to get there, so I'm hoping this will be my best season yet.
Randall's APU teammate Laura Vallis came in second. Ida Sargent of Vermont was third. APU coach Holly Brooks finished just out of the medals in fourth. University of Alaska Fairbanks skiers claimed the top two spots in the men's sprint. Eric Soderstrom won and Tyler Cornfield got second. APU's Mike Hinckley placed third. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Fite.
Legislators will have at least 51 new bills before them when they go into session later this month. The bills drafted since the end of last year's session were pre-filed and released to the public this morning. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports that some of them will likely get extra attention.
The measures will be added to the 468 bills left on the table at the end of last year's session and will officially be read into the record when lawmakers convene later this month. Among those drawing immediate attention is a proposal by Fairbanks Republican Jay Ramris that would amend the state constitution to allow the fiscal certainty that's become a requirement of potential users of a natural gas line from the North Slope. The amendment would allow the administration to negotiate long-term taxes for the project. The legislature would ratify that portion of the contract, guaranteeing a fixed rate. Ramris also is introducing a bill that would set up permitting and management incentives for oil development on the Outer Continental Shelf. It's federal land, but pipelines would cross state land to tie into the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Ramris says it's a response to local concerns about the risks involved in using tankers to carry crude oil from offshore wells.
It offers incentives to do above ground pipeline and gathering systems, which may allow us to pick up some commercially marginal oil fields. And I just think it's a very positive way to begin to have a discussion about mitigating factors to work with the Inupiats and some of their concerns and to do it in a manner that we're all comfortable with.
The bill would give all right-of-way and permitting authority for any development to the Commissioner of Natural Resources. It would also exempt any real or personal property from state taxes for 20 years, but it would allow local governments to assess their own taxes. Two bills by House members would require secrecy when complaints are made under the Executive Ethics Act. They give the Attorney General the power to throw out any complaint that's made public. The Parnell administration will not present any ethics legislation for the session. MATSU Republican Carl Gatto wants to make the federal Real ID cards available to Alaskans, although not making them mandatory. And Finance Co-Chair Bill Stoltz has a bill that would give a personal fishing preference to local residents when returns are low. The session begins January 19th. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The state's McLaughlin Youth Center in Anchorage is under scrutiny for sexual abuse of residents. A new federal study indicates that sexual victimization of young offenders there tops the national average. Most of the allegations involve male residents being victimized by female staff, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. Kathy Schinkel is a superintendent at McLaughlin. She says the survey's results are serious, but they need a closer look.
We've been cognizant of the issue. It's a very serious issue. Now, having said that, I am certain we do not have, according to the, you know, kind of the headline that was in the newspaper today, one out of seven kids. That would mean almost three kids per unit are being victimized by staff. That's very difficult to believe. So I think there are probably some other variables coming into play in those numbers that we need to look at.
The study is part of a nationwide survey prompted by the Federal Prison Rape Elimination Act of 2003. The Department of Justice survey used laptop computers to allow juveniles to answer questions anonymously. The youth were asked if they had been forced into sexual activity within a 12-month period with other residents or with staff. The rate of staff involvement in forced sex with residents in McLaughlin, 11%. Was higher than the national average of 10%. Alan Beck is the survey's lead author. Beck says the overall numbers in Alaska are about average when taking into account all types of sexual activity.
On a statistical basis, it's about average. Overall, nationwide, we found that about 12% of the youth have reported some form of sexual victimization, meaning unwanted sexual activity between youth or any kind of sexual activity or engagement in a sexual act with staff. The McLaughlin rate was about 15%, but on a statistical basis, it's indistinguishable from the national average.
Beck says the numbers should cause concern. The overall results include incidents of resident-to-resident sexual misconduct. 53 youth at McLaughlin responded to the survey.
We had a very substantial cooperation in the facility of the facility staff as well as the youth. And so we actually had an 84% response rate. So that makes the estimates much more precise than if the response rate were lower.
Beck says it's not possible to verify the allegations. Some surveys were discounted because of inconsistent answers. Schinkel says she knows of two incidents of sexual abuse of residents by staff at McLaughlin, and that has prompted action.
Some of the improvements that we've done include the ability of kids to file complaints or grievances and send those complaints directly off the units to management without having to go through staff.
Schinkel says five mental health clinicians are now on staff and rooms are checked at random every 15 minutes. Residents at McLaughlin have private rooms.
What we do is ensure as best we can that kids are supervised constantly.
She says male staff outnumber female staff members at McLaughlin. Beck says nationally 95% of allegations of sexual victimization involve female staff members. Beck says on a national level, the Prison Rape Review Panel will start interviewing administrators of institutions with high numbers to review policies. A former chief financial officer of the Alaska Native Nana Corporation has been sentenced in Seattle to 21 months in prison for mail fraud in an embezzlement scheme. The U.S. Attorney's Office says 45-year-old Clyde Thomas Beard, formerly of Anchorage, used his skill as a CPA to cover up charging his corporate credit card for computers, travel, a diamond ring, and other merchandise. He pleaded guilty in September and was also sentenced today to 3 years of supervised release and ordered to pay $188,000 in restitution. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the premiere of a new play about Aleutian Island soldiers during World War II.
He took the first steps to actually integrate the armed forces because these two black individuals lived with the white troops.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
A team of about a dozen Navy employees and contractors are visiting a handful of coastal Alaska cities, presenting a draft environmental impact statement for proposed Gulf of Alaska naval maneuvers. Depending on the alternative selected by the Navy, those maneuvers could involve use of high-powered sonar used in anti-submarine warfare and even the sinking of derelict ships using artillery, missiles, or torpedoes. Alex Stone of the Navy's Pacific Fleet is project manager for the Gulf of Alaska EIS. He says a major part of the study was analyzing the potential effects of the high-powered sonar on marine mammals that live and migrate through the Gulf. He said the draft outlines how the Navy will try to protect marine mammals during maneuvers.
Those involve things like having lookouts up there constantly looking for marine mammals. Anytime there's a marine mammal within safety zones, we power down our sonar or even totally shut it off if a marine mammal is very close to the ship where they really could be impacted in a harmful way by the sonar. We shut down the sonar. And that's just a couple examples. We have a whole suite of measures that we think really minimize the potential for impacts.
The Navy will be holding an open house this evening in Anchorage at the Fairview Recreation Center and will be in Homer tomorrow. Monday, they'll visit Juneau, followed by Cordova on Tuesday. A vestige of marine and aviation navigation during the last century is disappearing. The Obama administration is turning off the LORAN system. KTOO's Matt Miller has the story.
Aviators, fishermen, and other mariners have relied on the radio navigation system and some of its predecessors since before World War II. It's been operated by the Coast Guard for the last 53 years. An acronym for long-range radio navigation, LORAN works with at least three very powerful radio transmitters broadcasting a uniquely sequenced and carefully synchronized series of pulses. You're hearing an example of that right now. A receiver on an aircraft or ship could determine a location with a quarter-mile accuracy.
Kind of like a Doppler concept, if you will. And the time is a really critical component. I received the signal, you know, 5 nanoseconds after it was sent out, so therefore I'm this far away. Now I don't know how far I am. I got to get another signal somewhere else, and I can tell you, and then when those two intersect, it tells you where you are.
Retired Coast Guard Officer Ed Page of Juneau, a former LORAN station commander on Iwo Jima. But with a notice published in the Federal Register on Thursday, all 24 transmitters in the American system, including at Kodiak, Tok, St. Paul Island, and Port Clarence, Alaska, will be turned off and decommissioned. Lieutenant Commander Bob Manning, LORAN Program Manager for the Coast Guard in Washington, D.C., says stations on Attu Island and Shoal Cove near Ketchikan may continue until October.
On the 8th of February, the majority of the stations will cease transmitting. There'll be several stations that stay on air to fulfill international agreements, but all stations will cease transmitting by the end of this fiscal year.
The Obama administration last year said it could save $36 million a year by cutting the program.
We were directed to do that by the Department of Homeland Security. Actually, the appropriations bill from Senate directed us to do that.
The commandant of the Coast Guard says LORAN is no longer useful for navigation, and the Homeland Security Secretary says it's not a viable backup for the now widely used and more accurate global positioning satellite system. That's counter to a recommendation issued by an administration-funded independent assessment team. Decommissioning LORAN would cost at least $136 million, while an equivalent amount of money has already been spent for upgrades to an enhanced LORAN system that's favored by the British. That money is all a fraction of launching a single GPS satellite. Ironically, at least one supporter of GPS has advocated for continuing LORAN. The magazine GPS World has highlighted the vulnerabilities of GPS with comparatively weaker and unreliable signals in natural or urban canyons, even unreceivable inside buildings. GPS may also be more vulnerable to interference or jamming, a satellite malfunction, or even a hostile attack. But former LORAN station commander Ed Page thinks it's past time to shut down LORAN.
I think from a taxpayer perspective, it is.
Page now runs the Marine Exchange of Alaska, a Juneau-based nonprofit maritime industry information, communication, and service organization.
And I think from a mariner's perspective, thinking, well, really, I don't know where I could find a LORAN set at this time for a vessel.
With yesterday's notice, Coast Guardsmen around North America now preparing to power down and pack up. 20 service members are the only occupants of Attu Island at the far end of the Aleutian chain. Chief Brad Schlaupitz is executive officer of the Attu LORAN station. They maintain the big 625-foot antenna, keep the generators and 625,000-watt transmitters running, and also keep the nearby airstrip clear.
It actually does keep us fairly busy. When I first was coming up here, I didn't think we'd have enough to even stay busy, but there is enough to keep you busy all the time. And when you're off, you go hiking, skiing, fishing, a little bit of hunting. Oh, I love it. It's a beautiful island. Attu is just an amazing, amazing place to be stationed.
A month ago, Schlaupitz and his colleagues hunkered down for a horrendous winter snowstorm with hurricane-force winds. As soon as next month, he may end his one-year tour at the isolated post, flying home to his wife and family down in Florida. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Yesterday, two state departments announced an Alaska-wide multicultural effort to recruit youth and employers into apprenticeship programs. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
State Department of Labor and Workforce Development Commissioner Click Bishop began by describing the rewards apprenticeship offers employers and trainees.
Registered apprenticeship helps Alaska's youth plug directly into the labor market. Apprenticeship also works for Alaska employers. They're able to establish training standards and develop a loyal and a local workforce.
The new multicultural, multi-language approach was conceived by Norma Lucero with the State Department of Transportation and Public Facilities Civil Rights Office. The DOT already has several apprentice programs, but Lucero felt the apprenticeship recruitment efforts bypassed too many Alaskans, especially youth and their parents, where English was not the primary family language. Lucero says that situation has now changed.
The website and our outreach efforts will be available in English, Spanish, Korean, Tagalog, Yupik, Inupiat, Russian, Samoan, Hmong, and French.
Lucero then unveiled the new apprenticeship website. The Labor Department's apprenticeship coordinator, Jerry Andrews, said the new effort fills an existing recruitment gap.
We're able to affect many young people that we normally, I don't want to say would slight, but the reality is that now what we can do is dig down and we can see the real effect of true multiculturalism.
Andrews himself completed unregistered apprentice training. While he praises the employer of his youth, he says becoming an apprentice with the state registered apprenticeship program carries definite advantages for both the trainee and the employer.
Most employers know what they want out of an employee. What the Department of Labor does and what the Office of Apprenticeship does is put only the structure together to make sure that that individual is qualified as a journey level worker at the end of their apprenticeship.
Besides apprentices, the Department of Labor is also trying to recruit more employers. This is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Alaska's potato stocks are up, but consumers just aren't buying spuds this year. State Division of Agriculture officials are concerned about that and want the public to help. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Last year's unusually warm weather had a beneficial effect on Alaska farms. As a result, there's a big supply of potatoes coming from the Matanuska Valley, but retail sales are sluggish. Amy Pettit is a development specialist with the State Division of Agriculture.
We're seeing fewer sales at the grocery stores, particularly of Alaska-grown potatoes, and so we just wanted to get out there and encourage folks to remember that they can still source Alaska-grown in the winter, and particularly to look for Alaska-grown potatoes.
The Alaska-grown label is easily available in most supermarkets. It's a big blue circle with the words Alaska-grown in the center. It's found on carrots, cabbage, and other local vegetables, even some meats. Agriculture Division Director Francie Havemeister is asking the public to purchase Alaska-grown products. Pettit says that slow potato sales here are following a national trend.
There's a large supply of potatoes nationally on the market, and so retailers have the option of which potatoes they want to buy, and they can get them cheap. You know, we're hearing that they're getting outside potatoes, potatoes from the lower 48, cheaper than they can buy our locally grown potatoes.
Ben Vanderweel farms 100 acres of potatoes in Palmer. He says he's lowered prices stores pay at the farm gate and hopes retail sellers will do the same.
We try to price our product competitively. The supermarkets all carry Alaska-grown potatoes. I think the retail price is on the high side. Well, we just wish that they would lower that retail a little bit.
Jay Batak, an assistant produce manager at a Carr's Safeway supermarket in Anchorage, says locally grown russet potatoes are selling well in 10 and 5-pound sacks. Prices vary, but he says red and white potatoes are obtained from outside sources. A campaign to get local restaurants to use Alaska produce met with some success this summer, but Pettit says during wintertime, many restaurants have pulled back from using locally grown vegetables. She says root crops, like potatoes and carrots, are available all year long. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Former Anchorage Daily News reporter Peter Porco's new play, Windblown and Dripping, premieres tonight in Anchorage at Cyrano's Playhouse. The play focuses on mystery writer Dashiell Hammett's work as an editor of a soldier's newspaper in the Aleutians during World War II. Hammett brings black soldiers on staff at the paper, creating controversy over segregation. The production is Porco's first full-length stage play. He says at first he approached the work as a reporter, but quickly learned he had to write small when condensing racism, corruption, and World War II onto a small stage.
I wrote it very, very, very big, that first draft. I had 14 characters, 12 men, 2 women, 13 separate scenes, a half a dozen sets. I mean, could you imagine changing sets? I mean, one of the very first things my director told me after after we had the parlor reading of the play, he says, you know, you're calling for a New York City, a Greenwich Village apartment, and then also this ADAC Army Air Base newsroom. I mean, what do you think we're going to do, bring a big couch in and off the stage? You can't do that at Cyrano. So that was the whole issue, was to writing it down small. So I ended up with 5 characters, a single set, and only 2 scene changes, scene breaks, you might call them, including the intermission. So it's very now single focus, centrally located, one place set, and pretty tight.
Well, without giving away too much, can you describe where you pick up Hammett's story?
I pick it up at the moment at which he decides to hire a black illustrator, an African-American. Hammett, in the real Dashiell Hammett, he edited the newspaper called The Adakian. He created it and edited it there on ADAC as a morale booster. He was given the permission by the commanding officer, who was a mystery fan. And he had freedom to choose the staff. He chose 10 people, among them were 2 black people. One is an illustrator, and who became famous, by the way, later on. And the other was hired as a printer. And he took the first steps, or among the very first steps, to actually integrate the armed forces, because these 2 black individuals lived with the white troops. So they lived and worked as a unit. And so in real life, there seemed to have been no repercussions to that. But in my play, there are repercussions. So that sort of is the beginning of the plot line of the play, in which he hires a black illustrator. And the paper was popular as a whole anyway. I mean, it was a pretty interesting little newspaper, 4 pages, legal size, and mimeographed up to 6,000 copies a day at one point. So, So anyway, that's where we pick up his story. And of course, his story, Dashiell Hammett got out to the Aleutians after he had become famous, after he had done most of his writing, all of his writing, really. All his mystery novels and stories, they've all been published. He's been a well-known Hollywood celebrity, screenwriter, a screen doctor, a screenplay doctor for many years. But when World War II came along, he wanted to enlist, and he enlisted at 48 years old.
What, in your research, were you able to kind of discover why he felt so strongly about wanting to join up here? He had a life that he probably could have had a fairly easy time, and especially at 48 years old, it seems remarkable that he would want to trade Hollywood for battles in World War II.
Well, I don't think he liked Hollywood that much. I mean, he certainly took advantage of it in a lot of ways, and that included the availability of women. He was a famous man and quite elegant and charming. He spent a lot of money. He just went through money like water. He just, there was a friend of his, a screenwriter friend, who said that Hammett lived as if he didn't expect to live past Thursday. By the time the war had started, Hammett already had had a political career, as a political activist. He was a strong anti-fascist. He was very, very strong and far on the left. He was, if not a member of the Communist Party in America, he certainly did a lot of work for them. So by the time the war came, or rather, I should say, by the time America entered the war, then he felt that he had to go in and put his principles into action. He apparently wanted to go to combat, but I don't think that was a realistic hope. But I also think, my speculation is that he just got tired of living the life he was living. And this was a chance in some way, I think, to redeem himself.
Peter Porco's new play, Windblown and Dripping, premieres tonight in Anchorage at Cyrano's. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Matt Miller in Juneau, and Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Communication Systems. Whether your business operations are in Alaska, nationally, or internationally, ACS has the network solution to keep you and your business connected. ACSAlaska.com.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.